Welcome to the Women in Sport and Exercise Academic Network podcast. I am your host, Dr. Jackie Forsyth, and also co-founder of the network. The purpose of the Women in Sport and Exercise Academic Network is to grow, strengthen, and promote research on women in sport and exercise, with the ultimate goal of optimising women's athletic success and their participation. With these podcasts, we wish to bring you information from leading academics who are researching about women in sport and exercise and provide you with advice and support for the exercising female. Please remember our disclaimer that the opinions, content and recommendations contained within our podcast are for general information only and should not be substituted for medical advice, treatment or diagnosis. Anya Brislin is a lecturer in exercise physiology at York St John University. She is particularly interested in how physical activity, sedentary behaviour and exercise affect various aspects of vascular health during the lifespan. Anya gained her PhD from Liverpool John Moores University, investigating how menopause and pregnancy influence the peripheral and cerebrovascular systems. In this podcast, Anya gives an overview of the findings of her PhD and other research. I ask her for her views on the effects of taking HRT on vascular health and vasomotor symptoms among postmenopausal women. I also ask her for her tips on recruiting women for such studies, especially when women have to meet quite strict eligibility criteria. We talk about her future work, where she will be examining the acute effects of exercise on vascular structure and function in premenopausal and postmenopausal populations, and on the potential benefits of resistance training during pregnancy. So, Anya, it's lovely to have you here. You're an expert in more cardiovascular type of cardiovascular function, I suppose, but this probably started with your PhD. So can you tell us a little bit more about what you did for your PhD?
Yeah, for sure. So my main area for my PhD was vascular, cerebral and peripheral vascular function in women. So we were interested in kind of how the blood vessels work between pre and post menopause, because we know there's some physiological differences between pre and postmenopausal women. So my PhD was made up of kind of two main studies. And the first one, we did a cross-sectional study. So we recruited 100 women, 50 of them were premenopausal, 50 of them were postmenopausal. And we measured a whole host of vascular outcomes. So we looked at how much blood flow they had going to their brain, how they were able to regulate blood pressure and blood flow to the brain, how their arteries were functioning. So we've got obviously a number of different arteries in the body. So we looked at the carotid artery, so the one that feeds blood to our brain. We looked at the brachial artery, so just underneath the bicep. And then we looked at the function and structure of the femoral artery, so the one that runs down through our thigh. So in line with previous research, we observed that there was differences. So as we get older, and particularly as we are postmenopause, we tend to see some reduction in function, but also an increase in the artery wall thickness. So we tend to see that we have bigger artery walls and reduced function. So there's some speculation or some evidence that suggests that actually this is age related, but we were trying to look at whether it was related solely to menopause. So we can do some kind of statistical analysis and control for age. And what we found was still, even controlling for age, as women are post-menopause, there's still a reduction in function and still this increase in artery wall thickness, which alludes us to think that, yes, menopause does impact the vasculature, and that there's some kind of physiological changes that are happening that arrive at that change.
And this increased arterial wall thickness, is that to do with the kind of the lumen size as well, or is that something that changes in the intimal layer of the artery? Is that what's going on there?
So in general, the ion, we call it the IMT, so the intima media thickness, is like this kind of hairline that sits on top of the artery wall. And so with that over time, if that gets bigger, then we have reduced lumen size. So we have reduced space for that blood flow to pass through. So that's obviously detrimental, because if that space closes over, then we tend to have some kind of event. So it's kind of a parallel. So as the IMT gets bigger, the lumen, the space in the artery will get smaller.
And what is the cause? Well, you've mentioned estrogen potentially as the cause. What is the mechanism that is associated with that? What kicks it all off?
Well, I think there's a number of factors. So we know that our lifestyle in general is really, really important. So for someone who's a smoker, that IMT, or the intima media thickness, will be bigger than someone who's not a smoker. Someone who's physically active, we know that people that have gone through exercise interventions, we can reduce that artery wall thickening. So a lot of lifestyle behaviors. So we know that throughout the artery, we have lots of blood flow. And as that blood flow comes through the artery, we tend to have what we term shear against the artery wall. So it's kind of like a force being exerted on the artery wall. And so the greater the shear, that then stimulates the release of vasoactive substances, which allow our arteries to dilate and stay healthy. But as we get older, as our lifestyle maybe becomes a little bit worse, or with obesity, things like that, we have less of this shear coming through the artery, less release of vasoactive substances. We also get greater stiffening of the arteries. So the arteries get stiffer if our lifestyle maybe is worse, or as we age. So there's a whole host of things that can lead to it. Specifically to menopause, there's some evidence to suggest that perhaps it's because we have less estrogen circulating, and that estrogen actually helps our blood vessels dilate and stay nice and flexible, a casual term. But with menopause, we have reduced estrogen, and therefore perhaps some detrimental effect on the properties of the artery wall, if that makes sense as well.
Yeah. So you've explained it really well. I'm feeling really stupid on all of this, because I thought that with atherosclerosis, it was more to do with development on the intima layer. But you're saying it's not that. It's also an intermediate thickness, which is that something completely different then?
No, I think they're just closely related. So once the properties of the wall start to change, it's going to affect the entire vessel, not just one specific layer. So I think there's lots of things. So we can have, as we age, we have reduced elastic properties in our arteries anyway. So that's going to affect every layer. When you think about the structure of an artery, there's however many layers to it anyway. So if we have reduced elasticity, then that's going to affect the inside layer. So it's just like kind of a bit of maybe a domino effect. The time course to that change, I'm not sure. And I don't know if that is even known. So whether actually originates from, does it start from, I don't know, the muscle bed and then work your way in? I'm not entirely sure. But I guess where we can pick it up, or where we can actually measure it, is at the intima media thickness, intima media layer.
So is it kind of all doom and gloom then for menopausal women? I mean, because you've said that if estrogen is going down, maybe there's lifestyle changes, there's aging as well. But if you're relatively healthy and you don't smoke and you take exercise, is that good enough? Or is this all going to happen anyway around menopause?
It's a very good question. So there's two schools of thought around this. So one of them is that if we enter menopause and we're really fit, then we're going to help ourselves in the long term, which seems logical. There's another school of thought that actually, really, if you're super fit, menopause will still impact your vasculature. In terms of physical activity, there's quite conflicting evidence on whether our physical activity levels can alleviate like the vasomotor symptoms, hot flushes, mood, etc. But we know from exercise interventions that the exercise positively impacts our artery health. So although we might be still getting some vasomotor symptoms, and it's very individual. Like anecdotally, we see women that are super fit and have terrible symptoms. And then we have people coming in on studies that are less fit and still have no symptoms. So it's really hard to say whether fitness is directly related to these symptoms, because we're seeing such variation with the women that are on our studies. But we then see that if they are really fit, then they do tend to have better artery function. So although we might be suffering from some kind of vasomotor complications or vasomotor symptoms, which are not very comfortable, we always try and promote exercise because we know there's lots of other benefits as well as artery health. We can improve mental health. We can maintain a stable weight. We can help our lipid profile, lots and lots of things. So I'm all for exercise. That's my message always is be active, move more, you know, try and move away from your desk when you can, etc. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. It's quite a fuzzy line at the minute. So whether we can help ourselves with fitness, the answer I would say is yes. But in terms of the vasomotor stuff, I think we need a little bit more evidence around that.
And do you know much about the arguments to do with HRT and cardiovascular health? I know you've probably just studied postmenopausal women without HRT, is that correct? But what do you know about that, or what are your thoughts about HRT Yes. and how it affects vascular health?
So in general, from my studies, we exclude women that are on HRT simply because the HRT is going to affect these measures that were taken, which are quite sensitive anyway. So my understanding is that HRT is beneficial if we take it close to menopause. So there's this hypothesis, the timing hypothesis, that states that actually the closer you take that HRT to entering menopause, then the benefits will be gained. Beyond that, so beyond maybe 5 years, maybe the evidence starts to turn a little bit. So there was a couple of big studies published almost 10 years ago suggesting that actually taking HRT increases the risk of cardiovascular disease and breast cancer and things like that. But a lot of the people in those studies had been menopausal for more than 5 years. So when you think about the physiology, so we've got estrogen receptors in our blood vessels or in our arteries. So if those estrogen receptors don't have to work for a long period of time, so for 5 years, and then suddenly we start to influx this HRT and expecting these estrogen receptors to wake up and adapt, I think that that's quite a difficult, it must be a challenge. So maybe that's the reason, because the body is going to cope with this HRT, but actually it doesn't really have the mechanisms to cope with it. Whereas if we take it closer to menopause, those estrogen receptors are maybe a little bit more awake and alive and capable of, I guess, distributing the hormone replacement therapy appropriately. That's my understanding, but I don't have much research, or I haven't done any research in HRT. Certainly, there's been really, really good advances in terms of the knowledge in that area over the last 10 years, especially. So hopefully people are clearer on it. But still, we get women in on our studies that are unsure and scared and things like that. So maybe the message needs to be clearer to everybody. And then everybody's case is different. So everybody has different experiences of menopause. So does that dictate the HRT level? I'm not sure.
That's great. You've explained that really quite simply for me anyway, about the mechanism. So I like that about estrogen receptor sensitivity and timing. You've also done quite a lot of work on pregnant women. Can you explain what you've done there as well?
Yeah. So my second PhD study was an exercise intervention during pregnancy. So we recruited pregnant women when they were 12 weeks gestation, and we got them to join either an exercise or a control group. Originally, we wanted a randomized control trial, but it ended up being a preference control trial because people were just, it was going to be a long intervention. So 6 months exercise intervention. So people were either ready to commit to that or not, as well as dealing with pregnancy, which I'm sure for many can be an interesting time. So we had an exercise group and a control group, and we were looking at, again, similar to the menopause study, we were looking at cerebrovascular and peripheral vascular measures. So we measured them at the end of the first, second, and third trimester. And then we also followed up postpartum with a measure of the carotid intima media thickness on the babies. So that was quite a novel aspect of that study, was trying to follow up with some vascular measure, non-invasive, with the babies, that was, you know, easy for the mums to cope with. Some of them may have had C-sections and things like that, so you try to kind of meet them halfway and design a study that's feasible in some respect. So the exercise was a very low stimulus. So we were typically targeting people that had not been doing any exercise leading into their pregnancy. So the exercise started with 3 sessions a week of 15 minutes and then built up to 4 sessions a week of 30 minutes across the pregnancy. So since that study started, the exercise guidelines were updated. So the threshold of our exercise dose was not actually in line with the guidelines. So our exercise dose was slightly lower than the exercise guidelines, but still nonetheless, it was still promoting physical activity and promoting exercise in pregnancy, which is really, really important. So I think only 15% of pregnant women actually achieve the exercise guidelines. So it was challenging. It was challenging to recruit for, and it was challenging to keep people motivated for 6 months. It's a long time. But in general, we didn't see any vascular differences in terms of those that were on the exercise versus those that were in the control group. And so perhaps the exercise dose wasn't high enough, or the intensity. And that's, I guess that's just us maybe speculating, you know, if we haven't seen a change. Because we know that there has been previous studies that have shown that artery function improves with exercise during pregnancy. So our findings are slightly different to those findings, but there's some reasoning behind that as well. So the women that we recruited were healthy, you know, normal BMI, had the ability to be physically active. So perhaps that exercise dose we looked at might be more maybe effective in people with higher BMIs or perhaps complicated pregnancies, etc. But of course, that needs to be at a GP's discretion, because we don't encourage women who have some kind of contraindication to be physically active without the clearance from their GP. So the message from that study is, in general, be active during pregnancy if you have no complications. Otherwise, get the guidance from GPs.
And what did you find in the babies?
So again, I think because we had 11 in the control group, and 11 in the control group, 7 in the exercise group. So this is a pilot study. So we didn't see any definitive differences between the babies of the mums that were exercising versus not. Again, perhaps if we increase the sample size, we might see some significant differences. We couldn't say either way just yet. But again, it might come down to the exercise stimulus. So there's been a number of animal studies that show, so there's a specific one in pigs that's shown that the babies of the mums that were exercising had a smaller intima media thickness of the abdominal aorta versus those in the control group. But they had those animals exercising every day on a treadmill for 30 minutes to an hour, 60 to 75% of maximum heart rate. So quite a high dose. So one, I don't think I would get ethical approval for a study like that. And two, it's just so challenging. You know, every pregnancy is different and everybody experiences different symptoms. So yeah, it's challenging.
Oh, so you spoke about challenging and the challenge of recruitment. Sounds like a really difficult study to do. I mean, as well on your postmenopausal, the premenopausal women as well, it's getting that exact match for participants, and also recruiting women, like, as you say, are going through a challenging time anyway, just being pregnant. Yes. How have you done that and done that successfully?
A lot of patience. So for the pre and post-menopause study, I guess because we were at a university, you have access to women that are pre-menopause, but we were trying to get probably 15 women per decade from 18 to 70. So it wasn't, the pre-menopause wasn't too challenging because we had access to sports clubs and sports teams. I mean, there's participant bias there, isn't there? Because it's generally people that are interested in health and want to contribute. But I think what's also challenging is finding people that are not on contraceptives or have a regular menstrual cycle, things like that, because we try and control as best we can for all those variables. So I think that's the challenging part. So we often have access to a lot of people. And then once you go through the criteria, you realize, okay, only 5% of these people are eligible, which then burdens the question of, well, is your study representative of the general population? So I think there's value in doing those studies where we exclude and try and narrow the focus, because Otherwise, it's very difficult to interpret the data. But as well, when I should probably now be moving on to an ecologically valid kind of study in that cohort. But yeah, it's difficult because then I could get quite messy results and not really know what I'm looking at. So I guess to strengthen that, or if I'm recruiting people on, you know, at different stages of the menstrual cycle or on HRT or whatever, is I need to be measuring hormone levels. And that's something I didn't do during my PhD. So probably taking blood samples and actually measuring where these people are in terms of hormone level would provide greater insight into that. So in terms of recruitment, it was a lot of asking and a lot of asking people to bring their friends and bring family and, you know, message everybody and whatever. The postmenopausal group, we had a lot of volunteers from the university, and then I would go to community groups or community centres and things like that. And over time, a drip feed of people, I guess, coming through. It wasn't too stressful because it was just a cross section, so it was one visit to the lab. So in terms of time, you know, once people, I think, know, okay, I don't have to invest too many hours here, and then they get to find out things like their fitness, blood pressure, resting heart rate, exercising heart rate, things like that. So I guess if they're interested in exercise, then it kind of upsells it a little bit. The pregnancy one was extremely challenging. So we had a local clinic that I would go to every week, twice a week, and just sit there and wait for the right people to come in the door. So it was very time consuming. And some days you go and you would maybe meet 5 eligible people, but maybe one is interested. And then a week later they say, no, I don't want to do this, which is fine because people have childcare. And that's another barrier. It's like, okay, well, should we be offering childcare? And, you know, there's lots of questions. So yeah, it was just a lot of patience. Yeah, I don't think there's any quick fix to recruitment.
Yeah, well, that's good, though. You know, it does take the time, and it's good that you actively did that. And actually, you know, face-to-face recruitment works. So you sitting there waiting for the right person to come in, that is sometimes what it takes. So you mentioned the future, and you said perhaps you should do something that is more ecologically valid. Is there any projects that you're doing that are going to be simpler in terms of recruitment?
Yes, I've learned maybe to do this. I'm doing a nice study at the minute. I mean, they're all nice studies. I'm doing an easier study in terms of recruitment, looking at how the femoral artery responds to exercise in postmenopausal women. So like kind of what we said earlier, is it better to be fit? Is it better to enter menopause with exercise or whatever? But we don't actually know how the artery responds acutely to a bout of exercise. So if a premenopausal woman cycles a bike for 30 minutes, what happens to her arteries? If a postmenopausal woman does the same exercise, how does her artery respond? So we're just comparing the two to see, do pre and postmenopausal women respond similarly? Is there a time course to this response? So it's a very straightforward study. We're getting some flow-mediated dilation to start with. So we look at, it's a measure of artery function. We do this test and we get women onto a bike. We get them to cycle at an intensity that we've calculated from a previous visit. Using ultrasound, we'll scan the femoral artery to look at how the diameter is changing or how the blood flow is changing. And that will happen midway through the exercise. We'll do that again at the end, and we'll do a functional test post-exercise to see kind of what's happened there. We might see that everybody responds similarly. We might see that it's related to fitness, or we might see that it's solely related to menopause. We don't know. So it's quite interesting because it kind of follows on from some of the questions that have come out of my PhD study. But it's also, I like the idea of that actually we can potentially advise people in terms of exercise. So all the people that maybe doubt the role of exercise in menopause, we can say, well, maybe it's good, maybe there's not so much change. So it's the real world application that sometimes I like to think about with the research. For example, when I go home at Christmas, what am I going to tell my mum? She's going to be asking me whether she could exercise or not. So having that evidence at hand is quite useful. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. We're halfway through recruitment now, so we should have some data coming through.
Oh, that's excellent. So if people do want to be a participant, maybe they could just get in touch directly with you. I've got your links online, you know, your profile page on the university site, so they can easily do that. Can they contact you?
Yeah, of course. So we're looking for premenopausal women that are over the age of 45, and then anybody that's postmenopausal. So we're the finding people that are premenopausal over 45 is a little bit more challenging, I think, than just the postmenopausal group. So there is still a challenge in my recruitment, but certainly not to the same extent, maybe, as previously. But that's not going to be the same for all of the studies that I've got that I'm planning. So I am also going to be doing a pregnancy study at the university. So we're looking at, again, acute responses, but how do pregnant women respond to a bout of aerobic exercise, but then also a bout of resistance exercise? So looking at blood pressure and artery health, things like that, because there's not that much evidence on the resistance exercise in pregnancy. So the guidelines suggest that women should be doing 2 sessions of resistance exercise each week, but actually what impact that has on blood pressure and how that might differ between trimesters is yet to be revealed. So just an acute study happening at the uni. So that should probably arise after Christmas, I imagine. So yeah, so we'll be looking for more pregnant women to join our studies, hopefully.
Well, that's great. Thanks very much for giving us an insight into all the research projects that you are doing and have done. And you explained everything really simply in terms of the mechanisms that are going on. So that's great. And I look forward to hearing more about the research that you're doing currently. Thanks very much.
Jackie, thanks. That's great.